I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We're going to look at the life of Duncan Campbell Scott now through the eyes of a new biography by the author Mark Abley. He joins me now to talk about this book, which is a totally engrossing look at the sort of double life led by Scott, who at once is considered one of our best poets, and at another is considered one of the worst Canadians of all time. Duncan Campbell Scott was president of the Royal Society of Canada, noted poet and writer, yet at his day job, where he was largely a civil servant in the Federal Department of Indian Affairs, he was a supervisor of the residential schools program and accused of committing cultural genocide. He was a proponent of assimilation and vilified for his views on the so-called Indian problem. In this clever and thoughtful book, Mr. Abley encounters Scott, and the two have spirited discussions about Scott's legacy. Mark Abley, a Rhodes Scholar, is a writer of previous books entitled Beyond Forget, Spoken Here in the Prodigal Tongue. He writes a language column for the Montreal Gazette. What this book does is show the two sides of Scott and challenges us as to whether they can be reconciled. And we're left to ponder whether Scott's actions were defensible or forgivable. And it's not an easy indictment on the life of the life and legacy of Scott. The website for more is at markabley.com. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program from Montreal, Mark Abley. Mr. Abley, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Awesome.
So as I told you before we started, I saw the book in the catalog that your publisher sends out at the beginning of the season. And I knew nothing about Scott. I mean, I guess I've seen the photograph, or the portrait by Karsh. Mm-hmm. I saw that in a collection of portraits by Karsh. But I knew nothing about the poetry or the writing or the work in government. So there is, I guess, in the course of this interview, two lives to consider here. First to the poet and the writer. Just how important a poet is he in the sort of world of Canadian literature?
Pretty important, although not widely read now except in university-level courses. But I think a measure of his importance can be seen by the fact that when Margaret Atwood edited the New Oxford Book of Canadian Verse in the mid-80s, she only gave three poets more space than she gave Duncan Campbell Scott. Scott gets 11 pages in that book. And so, you know, in terms of historical Canadian poets, not those who are still with us, but, you know, in comparison with the E.J. Pratts and the Earl Burneys of Canadian literature, Scott is right up there. He was a member of a group widely known as the Confederation Poets. They were born around about the same period as Confederation. And he and his close friend Archibald Lampman are the two whose reputation has lasted best.
And you've obviously read some of his poetry. Is it any good?
He wrote a lot, and a lot of it is bad.
Huh.
But some of it is very good indeed. And the interesting thing in terms of Scott's day job is that some of the very best poems are about Aboriginal people. They're only a small minority of his total output, if you like. But in terms of the really high-quality work, many of his best poems are about Indians, as he would have said. And again, a measure of that is if you look at Atwood's anthology, of those 11 pages, 8 of them are taken up by the poems about Aboriginal people.
And in his poetry, they're portrayed sympathetically, right?
It's an interesting mixture. There's a well-known poem called The Onondaga Madonna, which is a sonnet. He didn't write very many sonnets, but this is about a woman from the Onondaga people, of one of the Six Nations in Canada. They live in Six Nations in southern Ontario. And the poem begins, "This woman of a weird and waning race." And then there's another poem called Indian Place Names, in which Scott does something that was really unusual for the time. But the time, I mean, turn of the 20th century, 100 years ago or a little more. He wrote a poem lyrically celebrating names, words in Aboriginal languages. And I don't know if there's another poet in the English-speaking world who would have done that. Just let me read you a few quick lines.
Yeah.
"They flow like water, or like wind they flow. Waymuchiching, loon-haunted Manawan, far Mistassini by her frozen wells, gold-hued Wayagamack bringing her wooded dells." And it goes on like that. But that poem begins, "The race has waned and left but tales of ghosts." So he was romanticizing them and celebrating them, and yet assuming that they were dying out or doomed to die out.
And you're responsible for the latter, I guess, right?
There's a large part of the responsibility, yeah. And then there's one more element to the poems about Aboriginal people, which is that in several of them, he shows them coming into conflict with white people, especially what he would have called low white men. And in that struggle, the Indian almost always loses. So there are several poems, quite a few in fact, in which Indian men or women or both die.
Did he start writing poetry at a young age?
He started writing in his mid-20s. His great passion when he was growing up was actually music, and his first wife was a professional musician. But in the mid-1880s, when he was a young man in Ottawa, he met Archibald Lampman, and under Lampman's influence, he began to write poetry. And Scott had a really good ear. So in terms of the rhythm, the meter of the poems, the lyrical qualities, he was extremely good. And so it's kind of unusual, actually, for a poet to begin writing as late as his mid-20s. But that was when Scott started. And then he went on writing it to the end of his long life.
And then would he be published regularly in the course of his life?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And in fact, in 1926, when he was, in his mid-50s, McClellan Stewart published a one-volume edition with a kind of letter plate on the cover, and it was the poems of Duncan Campbell Scott, a full-page frontispiece. I mean, this was the authoritative treatment, if you like. This was a symbol, a sign that Scott had really arrived in terms of his poetry. He was now, you know, from then on, really part of the establishment in Canadian poetry.
So he gets a job in the federal government, and I guess his family, they have a connection to MacDonald, right? Sir John A.?
Yeah, exactly. And one thing that... Okay, so first I'll tell you what the story, and then I'll explain a little bit of the background. Scott's father was a Methodist minister, and young Duncan Campbell Scott grew up in a series of small towns in Ontario and Quebec where his father was the minister. The family didn't have much money, although he had an uncle who was a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at McGill University in Montreal. And Scott apparently wanted to become a doctor, but there just wasn't the money to pay for that. And what his father did have was a connection to the prime minister. So when Duncan was 17 years old, he had a personal interview with Sir John A. MacDonald. Sir John A. wrote to the boy's father and said, "Nothing would please me more than to give your son a helping hand." And so at 17 and a half, he began in the civil service. And the background to that, because when I first heard that story, I found it kind of incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Then I read a bit more, and what I had never known or succeeded in forgetting was that at that time, in the first couple of decades after Confederation, Ottawa was still a really small town. You know, the population of Ottawa in the late 1870s was probably around 15 or 20,000. It was a lumber town that also happened to hold the government. And if you were a Methodist minister, like the Reverend William Scott was, it was very likely that you'd know cabinet ministers and the prime minister and so on. That's how small a place it was.
There's a great line in the book from him that he I guess he says that he chose to remain in the civil service rather than be, say, an author, as he didn't want one's livelihood to depend on one's imagination or fancy.
Yeah, that's right. I think... In some ways, Scott was a very fearful man. I mean, he could be very decisive, both in terms of his policies at Indian Affairs and also in terms of the literature he wrote. But there was also this reticence, this hesitancy, this nervousness, this scared quality to him. And for him to have taken his chance, to take on the risk of working full-time as a writer, he wasn't prepared to do that.
So he moves up, I guess, the chain of command, if you will, in the bureaucracy.
Exactly. He started off as a junior copy clerk, which basically meant that people would dictate letters and he would transcribe them and then, I guess, type them up and send them out. Pretty soon he was a first-class clerk, and then he was the bookkeeper. Then he was chief accountant, and that's kind of interesting because that means he knew where the money was flowing in the system and who had it and who wanted it and who got it and so on. And then when he was about 47 years old, he was appointed National Supervisor of Indian Residential Schools. He kept that job for 4 years, and then he got the top job, which was, as we would say, Deputy Minister. In those days, they called it Deputy Superintendent General. So from 1913 to 1932, he was the Deputy Minister. And Indian Affairs was not a department where, for the most part, there was very much dissent between the Liberals and the Conservatives as to what should be done. On one key issue in the early 20s, there was a significant disagreement, but otherwise the politicians basically left the civil servants to run the shop, and Scott enjoyed that very much because he liked being in control. He liked giving orders.
So how is he viewed in history heretofore, and especially by natives?
Until the mid-1980s, not very much was known about the work he did at Indian Affairs. And then a professor who's now at the University of Lethbridge, Brian Titley, a historian, published a book called A Narrow Vision, Duncan Campbell Scott and the Administration of Indian Affairs in Canada. And what Titley had done was to actually read the memos and the annual reports and to go to the copious archives in Ottawa and to see what Scott was actually saying in his letters and his reports, which other people had not done, because they tended to assume on the basis of not much hard evidence that Scott was sympathetic and kind and generous to Aboriginal people. And in his old age, when Scott would very occasionally look back on his previous career after his retirement, that's certainly the impression he wanted to give. There was one introduction he wrote to a book by a West Coast artist, Mildred Thornton, and he talked about his interest in the promotion and the amelioration of Indian affairs. And there's all these abstract polysyllables. Titley actually looked at what Scott did, and the results were pretty tough. And after that, Scott became better and better known, especially among Aboriginal people. And I think some of them had never really forgotten his name, but after Titley's book, his work became much more widely known, and he became kind of a byword for, well, I guess you could say, for evil.
Yeah.
So the first Aboriginal person, a friend of mine, whom I told I was writing this book, and I said I would be having conversations with the ghost of Duncan Campbell Scott, there was a brief silence, and then he said, "Can you waterboard a ghost?"
Yeah. Could the idea of residential schools, could that have worked? And I ask that question, I mean, it seems like an absurd question, but I ask the question because I'm curious to know if in his lifetime he saw that it wasn't working, or even in the planning even, that he could have seen that it wouldn't work.
Well, Joe, that's a great question, but I could talk about it for 15 minutes, and I'll try not to. Could it have worked? Up to a point, yes, it could. I think the system could have worked much better, although we would still have been faced with the question at the end as to whether it would have been the right thing to do, because the whole aim of the schools from the beginning was to make sure that Aboriginal cultures, traditions, languages, religions, and so on, that all that died out. And so if you are prepared to believe that that kind of erasure of cultures is justifiable in terms of the larger well-being, then I think the schools could certainly have worked a whole lot better than they did. What I found gradually, and I didn't do very much primary research, I relied on authors, not just like Brian Titley, but a wonderful book by John Malloy called A National Crime, from the University of Manitoba Press, about the history of the residential schools. And then I did do a little work in the archives myself. And what I found out was that there are quite a few indications that Scott really did know what was going on. And whether out of cowardice or inertia or whatever it might be, he chose not to do very much. He did make efforts from time to time to see if things, to see if the conditions could improve. I remember one case when there was abuse that was reported to him at the Mohawk Institute in Brantford in Southern Ontario, and he sent a memo to the minister at the time and said, basically, you know, this is nothing we can countenance. Indian children should not be physically beaten like this. But at the same time, because this had kind of got into the press, at the same time, when he was talking to the journalists, he said, oh, no, everything is fine. In fact, that school even has a long waiting list, you know. And he would also occasionally send letters or memos or whatever to the principals of the schools where he'd heard that conditions were really bad. About half these principals were Catholic priests, and the other half were usually Anglican or Methodist or Presbyterian ministers. And the government paid money to the schools, but the actual day-to-day running was in the hands of the churches. And Scott would occasionally send letters saying, you know, we've heard that bad things are going on in your school. Please do what you can to correct this. But there was no follow-up. And if the principals denied that anything bad was happening, or they said, well, we're doing the best we can, it's not like there was any accountability, because no one really would have dared to stand up to the mainline churches in Canada 80 or 100 years ago. They were tremendously respected, and Scott was never one to rock the boat. So the institutions, even when Scott knew that they weren't doing the work that they should have been, he wasn't really ready to step in. And indeed, what he knew as well was that the department was being very parsimonious in the money that it provided the schools, because the churches could turn around, and occasionally they did, and they could say to Scott, well, look, if you could only provide us with more money to run these schools, then we'd have money to repair the buildings and the food would be better and so on and so forth. But Scott was a very good guardian of the treasury, if you like, so the schools were constantly underfunded. And so, you know, both the churches and the government could say, it's not our fault. And ultimately, you know, the conditions were generally pretty awful.
So the argument that Scott posits to you when he visits you, the ghost of Duncan Campbell Scott, that is, that these were different times. And I guess what comes out of it for me as a reader is that, is it fair that sort of the social mores of today, or our sensibilities, can they be foisted on a previous era?
Well, you know, that's a vice, if you like, or historians talk about presentism. Mm-hmm. That's the word for what you just described. And to some extent, you're right. They can. That would be very unfair. And yet, we do it all the time, because otherwise, what right would we have to condemn slavery as it was practiced in the United States? You know, I think to some extent we have to. It would be very unfair to judge Duncan Campbell Scott by the standards of our time without looking at what was considered natural, normal, and right by the standards of his time. So I don't think in the end I condemn Scott as the infamous villain, for instance, that Maclean's magazine called him when they reviewed my book. But at the same time, I don't think we can excuse Scott. I think, you know, one of the revelations for me in writing the book was discovering how prevalent social Darwinism was in Canada and elsewhere in the world at the end of the 19th and the early 20th century. So when Scott was a young man, when he was a middle-aged man, the social attitudes emerging from Charles Darwin had tremendous sway in society, and people were beginning to lose the faith in traditional Christianity. And for the most part, what was replacing it was a faith in social Darwinism. And so there was an English poet by the name of Rupert Brooke who stayed with Scott for a week, Scott and his wife, in 1913, when Brooke was traveling across Canada. A couple of years later, he died in the First World War in that terrible slaughter. But when Brooke was in Saskatoon, he met an American businessman. And the American businessman said to him, we must be a morally superior race to the Indians because we have outlasted them. The great Darwin has proved it. And I just found that a really telling quote on so many levels, that, you know, a morally superior race because we've outlasted them. And Darwin has proved it. You know, it's kind of an astonishing statement, and yet, as I understand it, that was a very widespread belief in the Canada a century ago, and that was the context in which Duncan Campbell Scott was working.
And I guess if we want to understand the lot of Aboriginals today, if we want to, say, understand Idle No More, we'd do well to know about the life of Scott.
I think so, because the residential schools in particular, and also the other, some of the other policies which Scott was responsible for, they had consequences that lasted down through the generations. When I heard Judge Murray Sinclair, who's the law professor and Ojibwa elder, who's the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, when I heard Murray Sinclair speak on two occasions, he talked about intergenerational impact, which means that, you know, it's easy to say, well, the last school closed down a long time ago. Why are these people still complaining about something that happened in the past? Well, I don't think many people would say to Armenians, why can't you just get over the Holocaust and the genocide at the hands of the Turks? Not many people would say to Jews, why don't you just get over what happened at the time of the Nazis? And yet, some Canadians seem to think, well, we have an attitude of goodwill now, and we give lots of money to Aboriginal people, and why can't they just get over it? And so that's why I think it's very important to recognize what happened in the past, not so that we can just wallow in useless guilt, but so that we can start to look for justice for these people.
Where did you get the idea to conjure him up as you have in the form of a ghost that you'd have conversations with?
The book was first commissioned by Scott McIntyre about 4 years ago on the basis of an incredibly skimpy proposal. Looking back, I'm surprised that Scott McIntyre accepted it, because I knew that Scott was an interesting figure, and I thought I could make him in a way emblematic of what had gone wrong in Canada's relationship with Aboriginal people, but I had no idea how to do it. And for a year or two, I researched and I made a lot of notes and took a lot of photocopies and saved a lot of internet sites and bookmarked them on my computer and so on and so forth, but I wasn't getting anywhere in terms of how to write the book. And I realized, though I was having conversations with him inside my head, often along the lines of, well, why did you do this?
Yeah,
or how could you do that? And then I thought, well, why don't I give him a chance to answer back? Why don't I put words in his mouth? Which is a very risky thing, of course, to do. But I decided that to give the book more of a sense of drama and to make it feel less like a staunchy academic type of book, that's what I needed to do, was to bring that Scott back to life. And having decided that, I then made the decision that I was not going to invent things unless I absolutely couldn't help it. I was going to stick very close to things that Scott himself had written in letters or in memos, in reports, in essays, whatever, or that he was on record as saying, that friends had recorded in their recollections and memoirs of Scott. And so most of what Scott says in the book are things that I'm very confident he actually would have said or did say. So the amount of invention is small. Nonetheless, it's a risky thing for a nonfiction book to do.
Yeah, it's quite... I was reading in the middle of one of these conversations that you're having near the end of the book with him, and I had to put the book down because I had to answer the door or something like that, and I couldn't wait to get back to it, because I got quite emotional reading the two of you argue.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I guess there was a biographer in I can't remember now where he's from, but he's not from the United States. But he wrote a biography of Ronald Reagan, Edmund Morris, and I think in the biography, I haven't read it in a while, but if I remember correctly, he inserted himself as a character in the biography of Reagan. I mean, he had great access to Reagan in his presidency. Now, it's funny because there's an Edmund Morris in the story of Duncan Campbell Scott, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How much of his own life, of what happened to his own life, sort of the relationship with his mom and the marriages and then the death of his wife, the death of his daughter, how much do you think that affected his worldview?
The most important in what you just described is the death of his daughter, and I should explain this a little bit. Scott married a professional violinist from Boston by the name of Belle Botsford, and they actually met when she was giving a recital in Ottawa. For whatever reason, her regular accompanist couldn't be there. Scott, who was a very good piano player, Scott was drafted in to accompany her, and as they rehearsed, they fell in love. And then the Governor General's wife, Lady Aberdeen, asked Belle to stay on and give another recital at Rideau Hall, and I guess she was happy to do that because she was already falling in love with Duncan. But having said that, she was not, I think, the most natural mother in the world, and she was a bit of a social climber and in some ways not particularly well suited to Scott. They had one child, a daughter whom he was devoted to, and when his daughter was 10 years old, Belle took her across the Atlantic and dropped her off in a convent school in Paris, which she'd actually even visited with the little girl a year earlier. And so from the age of 10, Elizabeth Scott was not living at home. Just before her 12th birthday, her parents went to visit her, and they had one reunion. Duncan Campbell Scott and his wife moved on to Spain, and Elizabeth immediately contracted scarlet fever, and she died. So Scott's only child died in a foreign boarding school when she was 11 years old, and it was 2 years after that that Scott became the supervisor of residential schools. And I think that must have had an enormous impact on him. I mean, how could it not? Mm-hmm. And I think that it must have made it seem all too natural that children die in schools, because he'd had firsthand very painful experience of his own child doing exactly that. So when he knew that in many of the schools the death rate was 50% or more, even in an age when tuberculosis was rampant, it was understood by many people that this was a scandalously high rate, and yet Scott did what would seem surprisingly little to do anything about it. And I think it's because, as I say in the book, he'd put his heart in cold storage.
You have obviously thought about how history remembers or memorializes. I'm assuming you have in the course of writing this book.
Yeah.
And it's quite chilling when you write in the book how Scott warns you about yourself and how our times are judged. Have you come to any conclusions as to how future generations will look at us and our times?
I'm an environmentalist, Joe, and when I think of what is going on in much of the planet and in this country, in our country, I think it's pretty horrifying. And if there are still human beings in 50 or 75 or 100 years, I think they will look back on what our generation allowed to happen to the planet in terms of the gradual death of the oceans, the rapid changes in the world's climate, the disappearance of forests, and so on and so forth. I think it's quite likely that people in the future will look back and say, how in the world could you allow that to happen? And yet, to us, because we're caught up in, you know, a particular system, I'm not saying that I'm not, you know, coming at this from a Marxist or any other political point of view. I'm just coming to this as someone who cares about the fate of the planet. I think our generation or people in our time will stand condemned in the future the way that most people now look back on Duncan Campbell Scott and his generation and say, how could you deal with Aboriginal people like that?
You know, this is such a marvelous book, and it sounds like I'm patronizing you, but I'm not. I just enjoyed reading it a great deal, and I just realized that I could talk all morning to you, with you. Congratulations on this book, Mark, and good luck with it.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's great talking to you.
The website for more, markabley.com. The book is called Conversations with a Dead Man, The Legacy of Duncan Campbell Scott. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Mark Abley, joined me on the line from Montreal. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.